We are joined now by Stephen Gowans, I believe. Gowans.wordpress.com. Are you there, Stephen?
I am. Hello, Phil.
It's really nice to be talking to you, Stephen. You're on some subjects here that we need to know about. This issue of the New York Times, if we could start with that one, your title is Complicit in Spreading False Syria Allegations. And you detail in that it's amazing that they could even start this story. How this was, you might call it from scratch. Could you talk about what these allegations were, credibility of them?
Yeah, the allegations come from there was an investigation by the UN inspectors, which found traces of chemical weapons in Syria. But they said, you know, this doesn't really tell us much about anything. It doesn't tell us that the Syrian government has not relinquished its chemical weapons. It doesn't tell us that. It doesn't tell us that they're using the weapons. It doesn't tell us that they reestablished their chemical weapons program. It doesn't tell us much of anything. And the New York Times acknowledged all of this, but despite acknowledging that, said, however, there's strong suspicion that the Syrian government has retained its chemical weapons. And this is based on a strong suspicion that was provided by an unnamed Western diplomat who presumably been briefed on this. But really, I mean, the story amounts to...
How often do they get calls, by the way, from unnamed Western diplomats saying, you know, a lot of these stories are just plain bunk. And people ask me all the time, but I've never seen any evidence. Did they ever get an interview like that one?
No, exactly, and it should have been called, I mean, the headline should have been unnamed Western diplomat says Syria retaining chemical weapons on the basis of no evidence at all.
Exactly.
But he had a suspicion based on nothing. Mm-hmm. And then there were allegations about, and there have been for some time, about allegations that the Syrian government, Syrian military is using chlorine gas. And that's really interesting to look at, the story about the chlorine gas. Because first, and you know, you don't have to take my word for this, it's been reported in the New York Times, but chlorine gas has been used by Sunni militants in Iraq for over a decade, since 2003. So they're used intermittently in attacks against U.S. and Iraqi forces, and also against civilians. And in 2007, there was a flurry of such attacks in Anbar province, which is where U.S. forces were trying to wrest control of the territory from al-Qaeda in Iraq, from which sprang ISIS and al-Nusra, which are today the principal militant groups in Syria. So here's the principal opposition force against the Syrian government, having a long history of using chlorine gas as a weapon. Then, I mean, the second thing you have to consider is that as a weapon, chlorine gas is exceedingly ineffective. So it's lethal only in highly concentrated doses, and where medical treatment is not immediately available. And it's far less effective than conventional weapons. So now you can ask yourself, so why would the Syrian Arab Army use a highly ineffective weapon, which is deplored by world public opinion, and whose use would provide the United States a pretext to directly intervene militarily in Syria, when it has far more effective conventional weapons, which are not deplored by public opinion, and whose use does not deliver a pretext to Washington to intervene? So, I mean, unless you think that the government in Damascus is made up of a collection of chimpanzees of subpar intelligence, this makes no sense at all. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you look at this from the perspective of the opposition, they have a strong motive for using chlorine gas and blaming its use on the government to create a pretext for U.S. intervention. And then they have a long history of using chlorine gas as a weapon. So, I mean, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out who's using chlorine gas in Syria. Hmm. And also to determine that, you know, U.S. politicians and newspapers that are insinuating that the Syrian government is the culprit are lying through their teeth. I mean, just as Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Powell lied through their teeth about Iraq having chemical weapons to invent a pretext for war in Iraq.
I noticed you quoted that they said, of course, they admitted, the New York Times said, well, you know, we do have a small problem here that we kind of, because they messed up with the Iraq story, this still hovers over us when we're trying to look at Syria. There was, it was kind of a, it was almost like, okay, we admit we got that one wrong, but now you should believe us.
Yes, exactly.
it's almost like a way to get out of it. You know, I noticed that they also have this term, and I'm really glad you raised this thing about effective weapons. Why wouldn't they use weapons that work? They invented this term, barrel bomb, and now they've got everybody able to say barrel bomb, although nobody's ever shown that there were any barrel bombs. And I recall the president of Syria saying, why would I need a barrel bomb?
Yes, why would I need a barrel? I have far more effective bombs. Why would I use these?
And he and they never even demonstrated. This seems to have almost like been somebody thought up that this would really this. It, maybe it's because of alliteration has a nice ring to it, but it's they once they get it rolling. I think the people in this line of work figure, hey, as long as they got them talking about barrel bombs, we're a winner, right?
Yes, and if you look at the reports, you know, from 2003, 2007 about Sunni militants in Iraq using chlorine gas, you'll see that the descriptions of the bombs they're using sound very similar to what's described as barrel bombs. And those are the kinds of bombs that they would make. But why would the Syrian army make, you know, these jerry-built makeshift bombs when they have conventional weapons?
Mm-hmm.
So this is completely absurd and ridiculous. But I also think it's interesting to look at this in perspective from, well, from the perspective of weapons of mass destruction as mm-hmm. kind of a term that's used for propaganda purposes. Just recently, I was reading an article by a guy named John Mueller, who coined the term sanctions of mass destruction, which you may remember, to show that the Western sanctions on Iraq in the 1990s caused more death than all the weapons of mass destruction used in history. So 2 years ago, he wrote an article in Foreign Affairs challenging the idea that, you know, even if Syria had chemical weapons, are they a threat? And his argument was, well, if you look at the history of chemical weapons, you'd have to conclude that, no, they're not a threat, that it's the indefensible to call them weapons of mass destruction. So he showed, for example, that during the First World War, it took 1 ton of sarin gas to produce a single fatality on average, and that only 2 to 3% of those gassed on the Western Front died, compared to a fatality rate 12 times higher among those bullets, shrapnel, conventional weapons, which kind of makes the point of this President Assad, which is, why would I use something like chemical weapons or chlorine gas when I could kill a lot more people or a lot more militants with conventional weapons and bullets?
Yeah, it seems to be, really, this is, and of course this is in much of what you're addressing with the New York Times, it's a the propaganda value of catchwords and phrases, which get in people's ears, and they forget what the subject matter actually originally was and simply begin to talk about these things. By the way, I want to just tell everybody that we're speaking to Stephen Gowans. It's gowans.wordpress.com. The May 13 article is New York Times complicit in spreading false Syria allegations, and on the 14th, a very good article, Western Hypocrisy, Going Naked in the Middle East. Well, before we get to the naked part, I want to ask you about the New York Times. We should all be vigilant about them. They are really the guide-on, aren't they, for the whole media army?
I didn't hear your description of them.
Oh, I'm sorry. I used a military term, the guide on. You know, in other words, you start with that one, and everybody arranges themselves based on the work of the particular journal, in this case, the New York Times?
Yeah, exactly, because of its dominance in the media landscape. It's often followed. Yes, you're right. And then...
there was a time when we used to say the London Times, I guess, and all that, but they really lost their position. I mean, they seem to be bringing up the rear. I don't know of any journal that has this kind of automatic sort of gravitas in terms of shaping public opinion.
Yeah, and it does. And when you read it closely, you see the kind of, I mean, it's almost a transparent propaganda function that the newspaper serves in respect. And I mean, just the structure of sentences, like, what, I mean, they have to be honest and then acknowledge things like, well, there's no evidence for this and there's no evidence for that. But they use this interesting sentence structure, which begins, "There's while there's no evidence for X, it's strongly believed that X is true."
Yeah, there's mounting evidence. I love you captured that though there isn't, in this case, we don't have any particular proof, but there is mounting evidence, which means that 10 other people lied to you, and so now we have 10 people who've lied, and so it's beginning to mount up.
Right, and the White House does exactly the same thing. It's still said that there is evidence that the Syrian army used chemical weapons a few years ago in this infamous chemical weapons attack. And when you read the White House press release and the White House brief on this, and if you read it closely, it essentially says, we have no evidence that the Syrian army actually did this, but we believe it to be true.
Yes. Well, now, we can throw in others, and I think this is related to your Western Hypocrisy piece. We have Amnesty and Human Rights Watch. They seem to be kind of cheek by jowl with the New York Times in terms of saying, oh, yes, well, we can authenticate that. Mr. Roth recently of he's Human Rights Watch, isn't he?
Yeah.
He said, here's a photograph of showing devastation caused by the, I think it was the Syrians. Yes, the Syrians' destruction of a city. And it turned out that it wasn't even in that city, that the first photograph he had wasn't in Syria.
Yeah, no, that's correct. I think it was in Gaza, was it not?
Yeah, the original one, yes, it was Gaza. And we ought to maybe be objecting that they ought to treat us with a little more respect. They seem to think they can tell us anything. You know, that a guy like Roth wouldn't take care to avoid a kind of this is a rather big embarrassment. Now all week long I've been seeing some people are kind of stalking him and said, no, Roth, even your apology or your explanation is not accurate. But we have this role. We have the New York Times, and then we have these prestigious NGOs. And who are these people, the NGOs, the Amnesty and Human Rights Watch?
Yeah, I mean, Human Rights Watch, if you look at who belongs to Human Rights Watch in the principal positions, are generally people who have been associated with U.S. foreign policy establishment or are members of it, or some kind of Western foreign policy establishment. I think that, if I recall correctly, that Lloyd Axworthy is Canadian, is associated in some way with Human Rights Watch.
A little less gravitous.
They're like certainly an extension of an informal extension of the U.S. state and part of the U.S. ruling class. Mm-hmm. And even when you look at some of the reports, I mean, they would make allegations about the Syrian military using chlorine gas, for example. This is based on the testimony of witnesses, for example. But then if you look at where these witnesses come, or they're witnesses representing various NGOs or various groups that are receiving funding from the very governments that are opposed to the Syrian government and are trying to overthrow it.
Mm-hmm.
And the New York Times, the newspapers also cite these kinds of witness testimony to make the case that the Syrian government is using chlorine gas, because their argument is, well, chlorine gas attacks come from helicopters, and only the Syrian military has helicopters, and this is based on witness testimony. Well, who are the witnesses? And has anyone scrutinized their testimony? I mean, they're witnesses in areas that have, it would be very easily people who are associated with the opposition and have an interest in spreading false rumors about the Syrian government.
Yeah.
To spread it and to provide pretext to the U.S. military to intervene directly.
Yeah, and we seem to be really at the cusp of such of such a move, and I want to ask you about that. This is Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, what's left. You are taking up in your piece of May 14, you're talking about good old Bahrain, with whom nobody has any problems. The king visited our very own queen, Elizabeth herself, and meanwhile, that government's involved with the bombing of Syria and the bombing of Yemen. Tell us about what that it means to you in this visit to Queen Elizabeth. What that shows.
Well, I mean, the hypocrisy is astonishing. Today, I saw a former U.S. ambassador to Syria talking about how the Syrian government is one of the most horrific in the Middle East, which is really an extraordinary claim. You could make that claim quite easily about Saudi Arabia. You could make that claim quite easily about many of the Gulf, monarchies and oil tyrannies. That you would single out Syria is just completely astonishing. But we have Bahrain. I mean, certainly the New York Times doesn't talk a lot about Bahrain. The Bahrain where we have a Sunni monarch ruling over a largely Shiite population, which, as part of the Arab Spring, demanded a representative democracy. And for the effrontery of demanding a representative democracy, they were brutally crushed with the help of the Saudi tanks.
The Saudis sent troops.
Yes. So, I mean, let's compare that to what happened in Syria. In Syria, we had an Arab Spring uprising as well. And there was violence on both sides. But, I mean, the Syrian government is one that tried to make some kind of accommodation, recognize that there was some legitimacy in the uprising, changed their constitution to open up the political space, open up political participation, to open up elections for president so that you could have multiple candidates. But we see none of this happening in places like Bahrain or Saudi Arabia, these great allies, satellites of the United States. And there we have the king of Bahrain, the king of Bahrain who's not elected, who crushes those who ask for a representative democracy, going off to spend a day at the horse races with his fellow parasite, Queen Elizabeth, and the royal family. And no one comments on this. No one sees the hypocrisy of this, or at least not in the mainstream media anyway.
Yeah, by the way, I thought you had a very nice quote from Assad when he was asked, about whether you're democratic. He had I liked his point about, he said, well, maybe we're not a perfect democracy, but I think we're closer than your friends, the Saudis.
His point was that, okay, so we're developing. So we're certainly not on the same level as perhaps, Western democracies, but we're trying to move in that direction. And yes, if you ask us if we're democratic, well, compared to your great friends, the Saudis, yes, we are, without question. And I think that's a fair and compelling point.
Yeah. And you notice, again, now that was, it showed some irony, and it was a very nice quote. But we were totally deprived of that. Actually, if I didn't read it in your article, I wouldn't have known he said it. Which is, of course, why people should go to gowans.wordpress.com, Stephen Gowan, what's left. Again, we're not I don't know why this term is so used so proudly here about democracy. Our media certainly, as pointed out also with the New York Times piece, they don't share information with us. When Assad makes a speech, the speech isn't given to us. We're told it was a bad speech, or he shows he's losing his nerve, or they interpret it. I wouldn't know if he actually existed, except in terms of the criticism and the reviews.
He's been completely vilified and put in the category of brutal dictator. It's always brutal dictator. And yet, shouldn't the Saudi king be a brutal dictator? I mean, how is he any less of a brutal dictator than this depiction of Assad, or the king of Bahrain, or, you know, the Jordanian king, or all of these great allies of the United States, all of whom are royal dictators and brutal themselves?
Yeah, and by the way, they were all together to meet with Obama, whereas somebody said it looked like it was an arms bazaar because America was agreeing to give them every last weapon they wanted, every single one of them. No question about the type of government they have or what they might be planning to do with the weapons. And I want to get to this issue of the U.S. assassination of what they call the leader. But have you been looking at that story? They killed somebody in Syria, and they identified him as, well, he was in charge of the oil business for ISIS. But already within 48 hours, people said, well, nobody ever heard of this guy. And by the way, what difference does it make if you'd kill him?
Yes, I mean, the area...
Anybody ever heard of replacements?
I doubt that it's going to be that.
Are they going to say, well, let's give up and go home? You know, they killed the finance minister, so we can't have a government anymore.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, how effective have the airstrikes been in undermining ISIS? I mean, ISIS now has taken control of Ramadi. They don't seem to be weakening ISIS. Although, interestingly, in the Wall Street Journal, there was someone from the Pentagon who pointed out that the killing of this so-called finance minister of ISIS, which was done in Syria, was a demonstration to Assad that the United States could intervene directly in his country.
Bingo. That was the part that interests me. It struck me that this was more like... actually conditioning our population that, yes, this is something we do, and no one here raises a word. Although I have to say, and in fairness to Mulcair, he did say about the Canadian government that when they started to declared they were going to bomb in Syria, and this is about a month ago, he said, you know, well, that would be in violation of international law, and that is a dubious exercise. I would say to him, well, that's a start.
Right.
Because now the U.S. is doing it. Could you talk about this, the phenomenon? Why did the countries, particularly of the used to be called the colonial world, and then it was the newly developing countries, how come they don't have right to self-determination? Why can't they have sovereignty? Why isn't that automatic?
Yeah, I know. And there's such arrogance in the statement from the Pentagon, which is essentially saying, borders? Who cares about borders? Borders are immaterial, insignificant.
We don't need any stinking badge.
But it's like the whole idea of there's civilization, that's us, and then everyone else is just some kind of something that is below us, and we can intervene there at will because, I don't know, they're brutal and backward,
etc. Mm-hmm. Well, in Moscow, on the 70th anniversary of a rather important victory over Nazism and the establishment of the United Nations and the rule of law, they said, I noticed Putin said that really is where we are. We don't have, in the case of the United States, we have a country that does not respect international conventions and law and the foundation of the United Nations.
Right, they respect the law of the jungle, which is what you can respect if you're the strongest country militarily in the world. That's mm-hmm. the only law that matters to the United States.
Yeah, and if I remember all the rhetoric of World War II, that's the kind of person they were talking about when they defeated the German leadership.
Oh, that's exactly true.
It's kind of a curious situation. If we could only find Chomsky or somebody to ironize this subject for us. This is Stephen Gowans. It's What's Left, gowans.wordpress.com. And I really urge you, particularly the article Western Hypocrisy, Naked in the Middle East. I guess I could just, this matter, you raised the ambassador, you say the former ambassador, that's Mr. Ford, right?
This was one previous to him.
Oh, really? The way they've treated this in recent times is that you get the impression there was only one. It was at Ford, you know. He seems to be the go-to guy. But I guess the U.S. can rely on all their former ambassadors to say the right thing. Stephen, it's been a great pleasure talking to you, and thanks for the articles.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Talk
bye.
Soon. Bye-bye. Stephen Gowans. Gowans.wordpress.com. And Phil, you're pointing at something.
Yes, I want to announce Bertolt Brecht is coming to town, posthumously, of course, on this weekend at St. Bartholomew's Church.
Are his remains preserved somewhere?
His extremely ironic and entertaining and serious reflection on the seven deadly sins, music by Kurt Weill and text by Bertolt Brecht. This is a new group called the Friends of Gravity.org.
Friends of Gravity?
The Friends of Gravity. They're kind of opposed to the Flat Earth Society, and they are reviving this 1930s ballet by Weill and Brecht, which reflects on the seven deadly sins, and Brecht's interpretation of them is that in capitalism, it's when you try to do the right thing or the decent thing, that's the real sin. So it's a musical group. It's a musical presentation this Friday and Saturday night, just $20, 45-minute show.
Where is it?
It's at St. Bartholomew's Church, 509 Dundas East at Parliament, which the singers tell me is a wonderful venue for music.
You haven't been to this venue.
I haven't been to this venue.
You're going to be there.
I will be there, absolutely. And if you listen to the replay of my show from Wednesday night, Classical Underground, we interview the two conveners of this show, and they talk about the seven deadly sins of Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht.
And it is available. Mm-hmm. I'm always glad to see anything by Brecht. I would urge our listeners, if they among, of course, to see that. But the play, The Resistible Rise of Arturo Wee, would be very apropos.
It would be wonderful to see that again.
To read, if you wanted to read. And I credit the American Actors Guild, I think it was, who, after 9/11, put on the play as a fundraiser for their union. And John Goodman was in it.
Al Pacino was in it.
Al Pacino was in it.
And a lot of other big-name actors.
A lot of big actors joined in a special performance of The Resistible Rise of Arturo Wee, which, it was, of course, an analogy of with the career of Adolf Hitler. Brecht being Brecht, he set the story in Chicago, or just outside.
Cicero,
Illinois.
He liked the name Cicero.
He has that song about old Alabama. Yes, Somebody's got a website based on that Bertolt Brecht line.
Yeah. Oh, and this piece, by the way, is full of that. Brecht's peculiar understanding of American geography. It's all about Anna is from Louisiana.
Yes. He was living in Los Angeles. He listened. Somebody brought him some records, and he liked two singers, Lead Belly, which he very much enjoyed, trying to pick up all the lingo, and the other was Burl Ives. So put that in your pipe, as they say. Well, Andy, thank you very much. Phil Condon, thank you very much. I'm Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. We'll see you next week.